Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown. I am one of your hosts, Matt Koplik.
And I am one of your other hosts, John Miscavige.
I'm so terribly sorry, everybody. Technology is really awful, and John and I had a lovely minute and a half where we managed to go into the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We got into Elijah, the Eliza bit in Hamilton. Was a song? There was a faith spiritual song you were talking about?
You just tried to recap to these people, thinking in a way of, oh, they'll get it if I just kind of talk about it, but yeah, they aren't going to get it at
exactly.
All.
These are all buzzwords.
I know, you were just kind of like, you were throwing out random words. You were like, Hamilton, banana, gay pride. I realized because he had said Elijah, which is the same intervals as Eliza in a little show called Hamilton. And I realized that it might be based off of a spiritual we used to sing called Elijah Rock in high school. That was like, Elijah Rock, shout, shout, Elijah Rock coming up. And the Sopranos go, Elijah. And like, it was, I mean, those were three different keys. But I also, so fun fact, today's the first day that I've had coffee in the last 4 weeks. And I can feel every single one of my atoms vibrating. A-T-O-M-S. A-T-O-M-S. Yeah, I spelled it right.
So, this is the morning we're having, everybody. So John doesn't know how to spell atoms, and I'm recapping buzzwords from a long-lost episode. So
yeah, so
here we go.
So I feel like I'm going to be in rare form today, and I'm also just so delighted to be back and using my NPR voice that I don't think I will be speaking in any other way.
No, not at all. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming to Broadway Breakdown. Your butthole is very loose. This is to say... So, oh my God. So we haven't recorded in a little bit. John was out of town and then went off social media and off coffee. So basically was like dead to me.
Yeah. I really did lead a dead life the last couple weeks.
Yeah. It's fine. I mean, you've never looked skinnier.
Thank you. I do feel skeletal.
I feel like you look skeletal. I don't know right now. I'm bringing this up because John and I confirmed with John that we're going to record today. And then he texted me this morning and goes, so are we recording at the usual spot? And I'm like, huh? What? I thought we were going to Skype because I'm like used to us Skyping. And I just assumed he was still out of town.
He did not want to see my face, ladies and gentlemen. He had the opportunity and he said, no, ma'am, Pam. He said, I don't want to see that.
No, ma'am, Pam.
I don't want to see that.
I don't want to see that. Anybody? Valerie Cherish?
I know people who will get that one. Yeah.
There's like three people. It's fine. But that's our core audience. That's who we're doing this for. The point is, John has been in town for a while, and I did not know. And this is the danger of social media, is that because John wasn't posting anything, I had no idea really what he was up to. And I'm a terrible friend who doesn't just like text every day going like, yo, what you up to, girl?
Yeah,
that's not what I do.
Like, I've always wanted to know what it would be like. I think that one of the things that I'm so sad about dying the most is that when I die, one, I won't be able to go to my funeral and hear everything that people say about me. I really want to experience that. Because I actually kind of like try to lead my life in a way of like, that I try to say things so that if I ever pass or anything like that, and this is getting really morbid real quick, but that the people could look back and not have a doubt of how I felt about them, or that I really loved them, or I really cherished them, I cherished our friendship, those kind of things.
Yeah.
Just because I think that's really important with the kind of relationships that we build in our lives. But I, and from such an egotistical point of view, I'm so pissed that when I die, I'm not going to be able to hear all the people just being really sad about my death. But I realized by going off of social media for 4 months that the thing is, when you die, or as if you go off social media for 4 months, is that people forget about you real quick. You don't exist.
You don't exist.
You get, well, you get erased. So I know what it's like to die, everyone. And I'm back from the
grave. He really does.
And I'm pissed at all of you. No,
it's Carrie 2, the rage.
Yes. I'm giving
oh
you,
my God.
I'm giving you Voldemort of what you want. Speaking of, I'm about to, like, I'm almost halfway through the 7th book of Harry Potter. What I've mainly been doing this month is binge reading Harry Potter, since it's taken me over a year to read it because I was reading the book so slowly. And then the last, like, 3 weeks, I've just been like, bam, 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 bam.
Yeah.
Getting them out.
Because he hasn't been social media-ing.
Yeah. I've been really productive without social media-ing. And even though today, my first day back, I've posted a little bit, I feel so much better about not feeling the need to check how many likes I'm getting, how many... Mm-hmm. I definitely feel a break in the addiction aspect of social media, and I love that.
Yeah.
I really would recommend that to people, because there were so many times before I gave it up where I literally would scroll for an hour and a half just refreshing, sitting on a couch, waiting for something to happen, waiting for, you know, just that buzz that I'm...
I'm
gonna hit my veins with those two fingers like drug addicts do into the microphone. Hold on. Okay, so that's what I was like. I was just waiting for my next fix, and now
Were you saying you were waiting for likes to begin?
Oh God.
Billy, I'd like to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow caller. You're the top.
You're on a roll.
I'm on a roll. And listen, I'm also filled up with TV finale realness, because this morning I watched the season finale of Younger.
Wait,
and last night
hold on. Say that word again. Say F-I-N-A-L-E. F-I-N-A-L-E.
Finale?
Yeah. It sounded like you were saying finale the first couple times. I had no idea.
Finale love it.
Yeah, that's what I it sounded, you said, I have finale fever. I was like, what?
I just thought
sounds like something you get from eating bad calamari or something. I don't know.
Liza Finelli. no, TV
Ew.
Finales, season finales. Yes, this morning I watched the season finale of Younger.
Thank you.
And Sutton Foster remains a national treasure. And last night, my roommate and I watched the series finale of Sharp Objects, which I'm assuming John watched because he kind of likes it a little bit, or liked it a little bit. I don't know how he feels now that it's over.
I mean, I texted you as soon as I finished watching the finale because
I'd
been predicting this whole summer my different thoughts. And I think I did a couple times online, but mainly what we were doing was every time an episode would air, I would then text Matt afterwards and go, this is who I think the killer is. This is who I think the killer is. Kind of in a way, each episode ensuring that I pointed the finger at least once at every possible suspect, so that when the finale aired, I could go, haha, I was right, because I pointed my finger at like 12 of the 13 characters.
He literally texted me the very first time about this, and he's like, you don't actually have to respond. I need the receipts for later.
Yeah.
I was like, great, glad to know where I stand.
Yeah, I just used him like a dirty whore. And
it's gonna go on my tombstone.
So I'm not going to spoil for everyone the killer or who's the killer is.
By the time this airs on Friday, it'll have been almost a week since the finale. So I personally say have at. If you don't want the finale of Sharp Objects spoiled, skip ahead to, I'm going to just assume, 30 minutes later into this episode.
Skip ahead about 78 minutes, yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah, I don't think we'll talk about that long. But I had mentioned before, I read the book, so I did know who the killer was, and I knew that there was sort of a fake out before the actual ending.
Yeah, and I liked the fake out a lot.
Yeah, I thought that the show did a really, really good job in the finale leading up to really making you believe. So, okay, let's just say it outright, because we've established
skip ahead right
spoil
now,
it until,
it's about to get
skip
spoiled.
Ahead right now. Amy Adams's younger sister, 13-year-old sister.
Played by Eliza Scanlon.
Eliza Scanlon, who's British.
She's
British,
Australian. Like, she's Australian, and she's a new American treasure. She is a national treasure. She is amazing.
And I think she's about to play Beth in the new Little Women movie that Greta Gerwig's directing.
Yes. Yeah, with Meryl Streep.
Yeah. So I'm very excited about that. But so she plays Emma, Amy Adams' younger sister, and it turns out she's the one who kills the two girls that brings Amy Adams to the town. But you find out in the episode prior that Amy Adams... So, like, one of the big childhood traumas for Amy Adams is that her younger sister died of some, like, unspecified illness, and the way that it sort of, like, affected her family, affected her negatively, blah, 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 and, like, created this downward spiral throughout the rest of her life. And you find out that her mother actually killed her younger sister due to a disease that her mother has, which I don't know how to pronounce
it's
the first
word. Munchausen's by proxy.
Munchausen's by proxy, which is... Yeah. I thought Munchausen's syndrome by proxy.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you didn't know how to pronounce syndrome, if that was the word you were guessing about, you need another cup of coffee, sweetie.
I need three cups of coffee, hunty. But it's a disease where, in order to make yourself feel needed, you make the people around you sick so you can take care of them.
Yeah.
And it is a real disease. Did you ever read about that article about the girl who killed her mother because of it?
Yes. I don't remember if it's a Netflix series or something, but you could watch... You can watch... A video or a documentary about it, and it's so... Oh, God, what is it called? What is that documentary called? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I just found out that there is a documentary about that story, but the girl's name is Gypsy, I want to say.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's a true story.
If you've never seen it, go and watch it.
It's crazy.
It is insane.
I mean, we're going off a little bit, but yeah, it's a true story about this girl who... You know, lives with her mother, and everybody who knew them thought that the girl was like 11, maybe 12, and was like chronically ill with all these illnesses, blah, blah, blah. And then sometime later on, they found the mother murdered, and it turns out that the girl had met this boyfriend online, and they conspired to kill her because the girl was actually like 23 and not even sick. Her mother was... forcing her to go to doctors and get unnecessary surgeries and taking all these unnecessary medications and making her look ill.
It's called Mommy, Dead, and Dearest. If you haven't watched it and if you like fucked up things, watch it. So basically the fake out of sharp objects is that you think that because the mother has been poisoning all of her daughters in turn, that she must be the killer. But the very last moment, I mean, I guess kind of obviously it goes without saying that if you're listening to this, you either don't care and you haven't listened or watched it, so you just don't care, and so you're kind of lost and don't know exactly what's going on, or you have watched
it. In which case, still fast forward 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you have watched it, and so I kind of want to or you've read it, and so you know the twists already. And so I kind of want to talk about, because you've read the books and watched the series finale now, and I had read a couple places, because as soon as the series finale ended... which with one of the, I loved the ending so much, with Amy Adams finding the teeth of the dead girl that her sister has obviously now killed, which she had used to line the bottom. She used the fucker's teeth to create tiling for her dollhouse's bathroom. And Amy Adams finds it, or her mother's bedroom in the dollhouse. Yeah. And Amy Adams finds it. And Eliza Scanlon just has one of the most just deeply layered beat changes in the world, where she sees that she's caught, she realizes that her sister realizes that she's the murderer, and then she kind of smiles and just goes, please don't tell mama, or don't tell mama.
Don't tell mama, yeah.
And then it just blackout. And I mean, I had full body chills, and so I had to look up right away if the book ends the same way. And so you know that it doesn't, but then also the series gives spoilers, not spoilers, but it kind of caps along the series in like 2 10-second clips that are brilliant work of cinematography, I think. But do you want to talk a little bit about the book?
Yeah. It's so much to unload. The purpose of Sharp Objects is Amy Adams goes to her hometown to discover who murdered these two girls. These girls' teeth have been pulled out. Everybody thinks it's her mother, Patricia Clarkson, ends up being her youngest sister because she finds the teeth in the end. In the book, what happens is Once her mother gets arrested, she brings her younger sister Amma with her to live in the book at Chicago, in the TV show at St. Louis, and mm-hmm. she lives with her. And in the book, Amma, her younger sister, is really having a troubling time acclimating to life. She's violent, she's aggressive, and Amy Adams' character in the book just sort of assumes it's because she misses her mother, because it's like very Stockholm syndrome-y. Like, yeah. even though she knows her mother's been poisoning her and her mother's a crazy woman, she still wants her mother, because, like, at the end of the day, she's a 13-year-old girl who's severely messed up.
Oh, she's 13 in the books?
Yeah, I think she's supposed to be 13.
I think they say she's, like, 15 in the...
Okay.
Yeah, she definitely...
She's supposed to be 13 in the book.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and there were times in the show where I felt like she could have passed for 13, 14, the way that they sort of dressed her up a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially with that Persephone headdress she was wearing.
Oh, my God.
Scene. It was a great scene. Anyway, so in the book, all this is happening, and what happens is a girl that Amma becomes friends with at school goes missing one day, like doesn't show up for school the next day, and her body is found next to a dumpster, propped up in the alleyway the same way another girl in Wind Gap was propped up, and six of her teeth are missing. Not all of her teeth, just six of her teeth. And Camille... gets the notification about it, and she's like, oh shit, and immediately goes home and I think confronts Amma about it. And the reveal of the teeth, from what I remember in the book, they fought and sort of the dollhouse topples over and the teeth come out. That's what I remember. Don't quote me on that, but that's what I remember. And then there's sort of an epilogue to that epilogue where Camille has like another breakdown, and she
cuts herself again.
Because there's a whole theme in the book where how Amy Adams Camille used to be a cutter, but she had one patch of skin on her back that was really difficult to get to, and she always sort of preserved that one patch of skin to show that she has some sort of control. And when Amma gets arrested, she like goes right into the bathroom and starts cutting that area.
Oh, God.
And yeah, and then her editor and her and his wife sort of check her in again into a mental facility, and they take care of her again. And there's also more closure to the murders in the book, just because Camille visits Amma in prison and Amma explains how it all went down. Which in the series they do, as John said, 2 10-second like really quick cuts, montages, and they are very loaded, and you really kind of have to break it down to sort of see what happened. But you get what is essentially like 7 pages of text in the book in 20 seconds total in the final credits, and it's brilliant filmmaking. Just like really fast cuts to give you just enough of what you need, and then like two final shots of Amma that are just chilling. So sorry, I did a lot of backstory just there. So essentially what they imply is that Amma, these two girls who were murdered had become friends of Amma, and then her mother took interest in the girls as well and sort of looked at them as little projects, which Amma didn't like, because Amma's very territorial about her mother and the way her mother sort of takes care of her. It was also implied in the books that Adora, the mom, was going to poison the girls as well, and Amma sort of looked at that as her thing, and that like the girls were going to ruin everything by possibly exposing Adora if Adora did that.
I had read that somewhere when I was looking up differences between that, and I loved that as a thematic plot point, because it really just kind of drives home the whole fucked upness of it all.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed a lot of things about this series. Just kind of... But at the same time, I don't know if I would love binge-watching it. I really enjoyed watching it episodically in each week and having the kind of cliffhanger endings that it loved to do. But the thing that I loved so much about it and as well is that it really just moved... It took its time. It took its GD time, you know?
It definitely did.
A lot of the episodes, I would kind of sit there and I would just feel so uncomfortable, because I would just feel like it was, everything was just being drawn out too long, and I would feel hotter than it would seem. Like, I would be sitting in an air-conditioned room, and it, I think they just really captured the idea of this town in the way that they told the story. You just feel stuck in this tiny, claustrophobic, too hot southern town where everything moves a little too slow, even though there are literal teenage girls being murdered.
What I loved about the show was because it's like it is what it essentially is it's a memory piece in the framework of a crime story. The catalyst for the show is who murdered these girls, but what eventually becomes is an in-depth analysis of what makes people turn into the damage that they are. And I love the way that it played with memory, the way that the camera played with ghosts and memories. It's like if they ever truly made a movie of Follies, I kind of would want it to like be filmed like that.
Creepy, but I like that.
Yeah, well, sort of like, because it really does get how memories work, where it's never one complete like 5 minute memory. It's flashes. Yeah, it's flashes. It's silence. Sometimes there's sound. It's pieces, and sometimes, you know, you walk past a specific place or a specific person and you remember something and you can see it right there. And it's tangible. No, I liked the book. I loved the show. I didn't always love the show. There were times when I was like, I feel like it's going a little too slowly right now, or I feel like this scene is a little too much, but you also
binge watched it, right?
Like, sort of. Yeah. I mean, I averaged probably two episodes per viewing. I watched the first two episodes in one sitting and then the next two, and then I think I did three, but the last two episodes I did by a separated week. So yeah, like, I do think if I did it week by week, it would have been a little more easy to digest, but the overall effect of it I thought was really fantastic.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, if you haven't checked it out and you don't mind that we've just spoiled the whole plot for you, go check it out. And if you have checked it out, hopefully you share our opinions, but it doesn't matter because you're just listening to this podcast and we're the ones with the goddamn microphone.
These women, these young women who are just showing me and John up with their acting.
Yeah, these young, pretty women. Pretty women.
Musical. Pretty. Segue. Pretty woman, I'm using. Oh, God. Jesus fucking Christ.
I guess we have to talk about it, don't we?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I would like to sort of talk about Pretty Woman and go from there into the New York Times in general, if that's okay with everybody.
I mean, once again, we have the mics, they don't, so it don't matter.
It don't matter what you think. I'm going to say what I'm going to say. Did you read the Pretty Woman New York Times review, John?
I didn't. I saw a couple clips of Pretty Woman, some video clips, including some songs and some lyrics. And I listened to the songs and the lyrics, and I got quite... I got quite a very quick, solid opinion of knowing what kind of reviews it was going to get.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I didn't feel like I needed to read it. I also, in my social media-ness, there were days that I wouldn't check Playbill either. Mm-hmm. I kind of really stepped away from a lot of things that I check obsessively over the last couple weeks.
Sure.
So I actually just didn't even think, oh, I should... I didn't know what day it opened. This is me just admitting I know nothing. Even more than I already admit it.
I can't rightfully say that I, like, had it pinned in my calendar when Pretty Woman was opening, but... like,
don't lie. Yes, you did.
Yes. I was so excited for Pretty Woman Musical that I had it pinned in my calendar.
Mistake. Shoot. I've actually never seen the movie, but I know that reference.
Yeah, everyone knows that reference. There are a couple of movies that are very popular in, you know, our culture and especially with the gay community that I don't love, but I like but don't love, and Pretty Woman's one of them. Funny Girl's another, where I'm like, can we all just acknowledge that they're both a little too long and boring? But
yeah, I mean, I love Funny Girl, but I agree. I remember the first time watching it, I was like, wow, this has been a fortnight.
It has. I mean, Funny Girl, I think, is like a really entertaining first hour because that's where the majority of the songs are. And then the second half, you're like, oh, God. Pretty Woman's sort of the same, where it's like you have these like 10-minute segments that are just so much fun and like a cute little romantic comedy, and then these like five to 10 minute segments that are just drawn out and boring. You don't care.
I've never seen it. I don't want to.
It's a weird movie to watch now for the first time. You kind of have to take it as a relic of its
Please
time.
Please say period piece.
As a period piece. I mean, 1990. What a time to be alive. you remember 1990, don't you, John?
No, I wasn't born yet.
I mean, sure. Let's go with that. No one, everyone's going to believe that, John.
No, I wasn't. I was just barely a thought.
I was a babe in the woods. It's just not a great movie.
Is that where you think babies come from?
The woods? Yeah. Babes come from the woods. Right? You go into the woods, get your baby, and they get out of the woods. That's what Into the Woods is about. That's where I learned about babies.
Good. Son, your mother and I are going to come home and bring you back another child from Yosemite National Park. Aren't you excited?
That's exactly how it happened.
Yes, Papa.
Yes, Papa.
Yes, Papa.
Please select a girl this time, Papa. There are too many boys in this household.
Please, Papa.
Okay.
So,
yes,
let's move along to like what we were actually going to say. Pretty Woman opened, everybody, and Broadway apparently wasn't super having it.
That's a turn of phrase for it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't rightfully say the quality of the show. I haven't seen it yet. I did watch...
Yes. Disclaimer, me neither.
Yes. I did watch their two TV performances. One was the shopping scene that they turned into a song. And then, I guess, like, Samantha Barks' 11 o'clock, like, come to Jesus number. The first song was called You're Beautiful. The second song was called I Can't Go Back. And I just... Listening to the lyrics, I was...
Who wrote it again? I'm going to look it up
right
now. Brian
Adams, I want to say, maybe?
Who is...
It's Pop Writers. Pop Writers wrote it.
Oh.
I...
Sorry.
Okay, I'm good. So, while John looks that up, I was telling John before we were recording, something that makes me personally very angry is getting shamed for having negative opinions on theater... specifically, I feel like people are a little more eager to be negative towards film and TV because it's more far removed and there's more money involved and people get well paid and it's, you know, it's like a one and done. So people are allowing themselves to be more critical of movies, whereas theater, people look at it as a little more personal, like, oh, they're up there every day, they're like earning their buck, yada, yada. If the show closes, people stop getting paid, whereas opposed to the movie got made, everybody got paid, so nobody worries about it. So there's this sort of stigma with Broadway where, especially in the theater community, where you're not really allowed to be negative about anything because everybody works really hard and everyone should just be grateful. And I'm sitting here going a little bit like that's bullshit. I think theater is art and art is subjective and everybody has their tastes. And no opinion is necessarily fact. It's a feeling you have and then you try to justify it by analyzing what it is you liked or didn't like. And I think sometimes criticism can get really catty. If you're judging somebody on their face or you know, their talent and just going like, oh, what a piece of crap they are as a human being. They should kill themselves. Like, yeah, no, that's not a critique. But
did you read what people wrote into my middle school yearbook? That was like direct quotes. Whoa.
No, I was reading what the doctor wrote about me on my birth certificate. It was cute. Yeah, it was a great March 27th.
When they got you from the woods from the doctor.
Yeah, they literally like bring him back. Act two of Into the Woods. If I were the baby, they'd be like bring it back to the woods. The reason I'm going into this is because if you read the New York Times review for Pretty Woman, it is really a vicious review, but Ben Brantley is very specific as to why he's so vicious about it. Like, he's not nasty for the sake of being nasty. He very much points out that he thinks Andy Carl and Samantha Barks are incredibly talented. He says, like, Andy Carl is, like, a great talent. He was phenomenal in Groundhog Day. He says Samantha Barks is clearly very talented, very charismatic, but points out more fault for the direction and the writers. He was like, it's so unfair for her to have to try to be Julia Roberts. Like, it's an iconic role. She's an iconic actress, and she's a very unique personality. She's not a unique talent, Julia Roberts. She's not a super versatile actress. But what made her so famous was that herself, her own being, was so different at the time. And no one should have to emulate somebody else for an original role, you know? Like, you should work from the ground up. And the way that what Ben Brantley was basically saying was that Samantha Barks wasn't allowed to do that, and that was sort of the theme of the whole show, was that nobody was allowed to try anything new. It was, let's put the movie on stage, let's not change a whit of dialogue, let's add really bland songs where it's not necessary, and, you know, call it a new work. And I think, and I'm honestly with him on that. I think we should be allowed to call out things like that when it's happening, because if you give every new show a blue ribbon just because people worked on it, it's like, great, so then what's the point of ever creating something ever again if people aren't going to, like, really look into what you're doing and, like, figure out the craft you're doing, or, like, why even strive to do better if everyone's just going to get a blue ribbon all the time? You know?
Yeah, I do know. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of that. I'm also going to play, like, a little bit of devil's advocate.
Go for
it. Some ways, because we've been talking about this a little bit, because then there's the flip side to where people have said some really negative, nasty things in the past on social media and on their platforms about their opinions of a show or something, or of a performance. And the first thing that came to my mind was the Godspell actress, Morgan James, who a couple of years, was it the Into the Woods,
it was
Shakespeare in the Park?
She went to the dress rehearsal, the final dress rehearsal of Shakespeare in the Park's Into the Woods, and posted on social
starring
media.
Sharp Objects. Star Amy Adams as the baker's wife in that production. And that her opinion kind of then catapulted her into an area of, I don't want to work with this person because she's negative, she's bitchy, she's this, she's that. But it's so interesting because we live in such a reactive culture because of social media. We've seen this so many times over and over again through Great Comet. We've seen social media bring about the demise of a show in that way. We've seen it over and over again, and so it's so interesting. And I don't have the answer. I don't know what the answer is, because at the same time, we're taught that we have to think for ourselves, that we have to stand by our opinions, that we have to feel what we want to feel. But then sometimes if you express them, and here's the thing, not everyone's going to like what you're going to say. That person takes... We have an awful habit of a society of taking someone else's opinion, which is all that it is, someone's opinion, and taking it as a personal attack if you don't agree with that person's opinion. And I honestly think it's dangerous in a lot of ways, but I don't understand it enough. Okay, this is a big tangent, but I swear it's kind of related. I've been listening the last couple of weeks to a lot of different comedians, and I found this one British comedian. Her name is Sarah Pascoe, and she... did this four-part radio series on a BBC radio network called The Modern Monkey. And she basically covers four aspects of our society. The first episode is on murder. Second episode is on jealousy. The third episode is on territory. And the fourth episode is on charity. And so she kind of discusses all of these concepts and where they derive from in our human nature, how we deal with them now, and kind of where it comes from of an evolutionary standpoint of, like, a point of view. And it's just very interesting because I've also still been reading that Sapiens book, which is a history of humankind, and kind of explaining why we got to where we are. And one of the things that she brings up a lot is social media, and especially in the jealousy episode, she kind of explains that feeling that I'm sure all of us understand, where you see someone post on social media, I'm so excited to finally announce the ink's finally dry, cat's out of the bag. And these people are sharing their excitement for a big life event for themselves. And yet, a lot of times we feel very happy for them, but there's also those times when we feel super jealous. And I think we'd be doing a great disservice to ourselves as humans if we don't admit, like, I'm going to admit so many times that as many times as I mock people saying those things, there's a part of me that, this deep, dark part of me that goes, oh my gosh, they're getting their Broadway debut and I haven't had my Broadway debut. I must be nothing. They must be better than me. I am jealous of them. And she kind of goes and explains that we are living in a world where our emotional evolutional journey has not caught up to where we should be, because it's taken tens of thousands of years for us to get to this point, and then suddenly in the last 100 years, let alone in the last decade, we've had a huge technological just shooting like straight up into the sky, just in like trajectory that evolutionary wise our emotions and our brains cannot handle all of this overstimulation of other people's opinions. Because tribes used to be, human tribes, for some reason, up until the evolutionary or the agricultural evolution, we used to live in tribes of like 150 or less, because that was all our brains could handle stimulation from. When there were more than 150 people, that's when chaos broke out. And so it's just interesting to look at all the chaos, all these negative feelings, all these negative outcomes that are happening because of social media, because of this huge influx of so many opinions constantly being thrown at our eyes. It just kind of, to me, it makes sense as to why we're all kind of bewildered and feeling our way in the dark, because we literally don't know how to catch up with it. And so I would also recommend, along with reading Sapiens, on YouTube, you could find this Modern Monkey radio series. They're only like half an hour each, but they're just so interesting. And she basically explains why we feel so many awful things that we feel. And then she explains some amazing things that we feel, like charity, like, you know, empathy, being a human race that's heading more towards empathy now. But it's super interesting. And so I think it's all kind of connected to the fact that what you were saying, you know, we don't know anymore. A lot of times you get berated, you get a slap on the hand for sharing a negative opinion because it hurts someone. But at the mm-hmm. same time, it's very rare that anyone's opinion is completely without bloodshed, for lack of a better term. Like, no matter what, your opinion in the millions of people that live in this world, it's going to offend at least one person. It's just whether your opinion is going to offend more than, you know, X amount of people or less than X amount of people. And it's just very interesting. That being said, I don't think that we should just go around being like, fuck you, you're ugly. Fuck, you know, I'm not saying that at all. Like, fuck you, that show's a piece of shit. You know, like, I think there's a constructive way to do a lot of these things. But I agree. Like, I think it's interesting because in some ways we're not allowed to have opinions anymore.
No.
But even that is having an opinion, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, so what I was going to say was, I don't want to, like, trash internet or social media in a ton, because there's a lot of good to it. Like, I've been able to communicate with a lot of people I would never have just people like who love theater, people who want to, like, I get people ask me about my opinion for theater via internet and social media, and that's very dangerous because, like, that can give people a sort of sense of entitlement of, there are people out there who desperately want to know my opinion, so I'm going to be an authority figure on this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What I don't like about social media in terms of Twitter, and the same thing with the Morgan James thing, is that because with social media, we really only can absorb little nuggets. We can't really absorb mm-hmm. full-on things. So for something like a tweet, you can't really go in depth on an opinion on Twitter. If you're going to, you know, like or not like a show or say how you feel about an actor or actress, it's going to be like two sentences tops. And you just can't word it well enough to make people understand where you're coming from. And so that is when it becomes, if it's negative, it's going to be snippy and catty. It's going to be like, gross, this thing, or yay, this thing. And that's just not great. The Morgan James thing was that. Plus, it was the fact that she tweeted it after a dress rehearsal that everyone was like, give them a minute to, like, find their footing. Right. I mean, in the end, she ended up being right, not to drag the actors, but that production was just very, the director basically was like, I have a million ideas and none of them have to do with Into the Woods, and just threw it on a stage. But, and like, but what I just said, like that last sentence I just said was longer than what Morgan James wrote on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like, she wrote four words that were just very nasty, and everybody was like, that's, like, you're in the community. Don't drag people so early in their process. You know what this is like. But that also is a good point of reference to make that I think sort of shows a lot of hypocrisy in the theater community, because I see actors post all the time about, like, why are reviewers necessary anymore? They're just always so outwardly negative. No one understands what it is that we do. And I'm like, okay, yes and no. like we like it is a wonderful thing to be able to get to do what you love, and it is devastating to work hard on something and then mm-hmm. to find people not liking it. I've been a part of that myself.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Same. All the time.
I mean, I've literally had every single kind of creative process you can think of where it goes like something that you think is going to be amazing and everybody fucking hates it. Something you think is going to be a disaster and then people end up loving it. Yeah. And then also where you're doing something and you know it's going to be terrible and everyone thinks it's terrible and you do something you love and everybody loves it. And like it's a mixed bag. But it does come with the territory. You do sign up for this kind of life that requires, opinions from everybody. Like, it's not like you're a you build a bridge, the bridge stays up, everyone can rightfully say you did a good job with this bridge, it does its purpose, it stays up and it holds the people who are traveling. Mm-hmm. With a show, with a book, with a play, whatever, as you said, like, there are gonna be people who don't like it, people who do, and you kind of just have to have thick enough skin to accept that.
Yeah.
Where I get actually upset though is when I don't think people truly worked hard on it. And it sort of just became a cash grab. And that is where Broadway is sort of at a fork in the road.
We've had completely.
We've been very spoiled the last 3 years where we had some really phenomenal shows that took wild chances, some with really well-known material, some with original ideas, some lesser-known material. In the last 3 years alone, we've had Fun Home, Hamilton. We've had Dear Evan Hansen and Great Comet. And then this just coming season, we have a lot of movies being turned into musicals, and not even in a creative kind of way. Like, what I'll always give Groundhog Day, and I think everyone needs to at least acknowledge about Groundhog Day. I loved it. We all know I loved it. And I know a lot of people who didn't love it. They were not content with just putting the movie on stage verbatim. Mm-hmm. They very much decided they wanted to figure out how to make it into a musical, and their own form of a musical. What Pretty Woman, from what I'm reading and from what I'm seeing, is people going, the I don't know how much is the creative staff, how much of it is the producers going, this is a well-known property, we want this to run as long as possible, give the audience what they know, and don't worry about anything else. And that makes me fucking angry. And including writers who've with the exception of Jerry Mitchell, the majority of that creative team are people who don't do theater. Like, the book writer, the songwriters have never done theater before.
Right.
And, like, sometimes you get some really great works from people who try new things for theater.
Duncan Sheik,
exactly. Burt Bacharach did a great score for Promises. Tina Fey, despite how I feel about Mean Girls, I do think tried her best to make a musical libretto, and there is a kind of craft and a kind of knowledge that has to come from musical theater writing specifically, because theater is its own beast, but a musical is a weird kind of thing to write, because you have to really figure out how to make a project sing and dance and flow. I think people love the idea of, oh, this is so-and-so's first musical theater score, and it's going to be cool, and it's, oh, so-and-so's first libretto. It's like, yeah, I'm all excited about that, but I feel like it's not something you can just fall into. You really kind of have to know what to do.
Well, right, even like comparing Legally Blonde and Pretty Woman, if you do that for a second, you look at the people who wrote each product, and we have Larry O'Keefe, who is a celebrated theater writer who has obviously studied the craft, who has honed his craft, who knows how to seamlessly kind of integrate lyrics that are smart, witty, of the character's mindset, something that the character would say, but that also serve a lyrical purpose and drive the plot. And then you have someone, like Bryan Adams, who I'm not super familiar with his work. I mean, I'm sure I am in a subconscious level, but I can't name it off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I hate to keep harping on the same thing, but it's the only thing I have to go from it, because it's, like you said, I haven't seen the show. But just the clips that I have seen of it, I mean, it's just because you can rhyme words together doesn't mean that you're a good lyricist.
Yeah.
And just because you can force rhyme the same words with each other, doesn't mean you're a good lyricist. Just because you can copy, if you were a dressmaker and you had a pattern that is the most typical kind of pattern to do, and you made it in a slightly different fabric. You can't say, oh, I designed this dress completely from scratch. No, you didn't. You just, you know, you took a product that's already well-known, Pretty Woman, mm-hmm. and you just kind of...
You inserted...
There's a level of craftsmanship and artistry that's missing,
I think. I 100% agree, and I don't want to end this on a super negative note, just because
I do. I'm mad now.
I mean, let's go the sharp objects route. Don't tell mama.
This has nothing to do with anything in my life. I don't know why I got so passionate.
Well, because I mean, I'm passionate about it because I have personally loved musical theater. I've loved theater in general, Broadway, since I was a child. Like it's been the thing that I've always gravitated towards, and I've spent the majority of my life really
since your limp wrists dropped. You know,
exactly. Like,
the first time
my testicles never descended, my wrists
it was
did.
Your limp wrists.
Yeah, exactly. I get passionate about this kind of shit because I always have been, and it's something that I believe in. And Kitty Carlisle Hart used to say that, like, one of the few things that America created culturally speaking was the musical, like the American musical. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few cultural things that we can claim ownership of, that and jazz. And not everything has to move the musical forward or expand it, but...
Right. I love Legally Blonde.
Yeah, but, like, Legally Blonde, even, is writers who, like, know how a musical works. Exactly. If there are moments of Legally Blonde that I think do kind of lean into, oh, we gotta give the audience a little bit of what they want, there are other moments where I'm like, no, they actually worked really hard. Like, Lord knows I love the Bend and Snap number. It's just so catchy. It has no actual reason to be there other than... it's known from the movie. But mm-hmm. the chip on my shoulder sequence from Legally Blonde is, like, fantastic musical theater writing. It is a whole musical... Yeah, through song and through dialogue, they travel through a whole semester of law school and show a progression for Elle. I'm like, that is a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical sequence right there, and it's great. I guarantee you there's nothing like that in Pretty Woman. And there was nothing like that in Finding Neverland, which I'll always bring up to drag through the mud again, because that was the...
You did not care for it.
I mean, that was the angriest I think I've ever been in a theater, because that was a show where it was very evident that nobody on that creative team thought about how to actually make it a musical or why it needed to be a musical. They just said, what a great idea. Let's throw in a bunch of random songs and give the audience all the hot things. So... people in corsets singing pop songs, So You Think You Can Dance choreography, literally a set that looked like a Pinterest board. It's... I mean, there's no, like, clarity to something like that. There's no vision. There's no directive.
I need to know who from the Finding Neverland creative team hurt your family. I need to know. Guess you never can tell.
Side note, linking into this tangent, I interviewed a gentleman last week named Harvey Evans. Harvey Evans has been on Broadway since he was 16 in, like, the early 50s.
Same.
And, I mean, dreams, literally dreams. Like, booked work with Gwen Verdon in New Girl in Town, and then literally worked on Broadway up until the early 2000s as a dancer, as a singer, as an actor. Has done movies, TV movies, like, has worked with everybody, absolutely everybody.
Mm, that's amazing.
He was in the original Follies. He was the original young buddy in Follies. He was a Jet in West Side Story. He did
when
Gypsy.
You're a Jet, you're a Jet all the way, too.
From your first pirouette to your last grand jeté.
Oh,
I can't take ownership of the lyrics. Somebody else wrote that. But
bye.
He was saying, like, with Follies, the reason why that production was so made such an impression was because everybody working on it had deep roots in the theater, had, like, really spent their entire lives dedicated to the theater, and at that point had really sort of reached the top of their talents.
Mm.
And I can't rightfully say that we have a slew of creatives right now, at least on the up and coming side, that are in that same pool. We have some people who's really spent their whole life in the theater, but can't really reach the peak of their talents because producers and directors won't take a chance on younger writers. They instead go to Bryan Adams to write Pretty Woman. Or we have people who are, you know, maybe at the height of their powers, but don't have a deep root in the deep roots in the theater, like Bryan Adams, or the Finding Neverland writing staff.
Every time I'm creating a drinking game now. Every time from the rest of this series on, no matter if we do 2 more episodes, 1,000 more episodes, every time Matt says an angry comment on about Finding Neverland, take a shot. I don't care if it's 11 a.m. I don't care what time it is. Take a shot of something weird to Bailey's. Take a shot of Bailey's.
I also want to do a running joke of like anytime something's just like really cluttered and a disaster, I don't know, like whiskey at 11 a.m. and cluttered papers and dirty laundry and rats on the corner. What is this? The writer's room for Finding Neverland? I just want something like that. The production table for Finding Neverland.
Just finish what you were saying. I don't even know anymore. I don't remember.
I don't know what I'm saying. But Harvey saying that, as I said, sort of made me realize that we have a lot of very talented people working on Broadway right now, especially on the creative side. But with that, I do not want anyone to think that Broadway and the musical is dead. We have some amazing writers. I could list you off a bunch. I could list you off amazing directors too.
Yeah.
This season and the second half of this past season has just made me sad because we either are incorporating very talented people who know nothing about theater for the gimmick of saying, oh, we have a score by such and such, a script by such and such, or we're taking directors and choreographers and applying them to projects where they can't actually use their knowledge because they have to literally translate a film to stage.
Yeah.
And that's just, that makes me sad. So I'm hoping that we're just in a little bit of a lull. I will say, I've said it in a previous episode, and I'll say it again, I'm very excited for Tootsie because that is a property that I think could make a good musical. They do have people who understand theater working on that. David Yazbek writing the score and Scott Ellis doing the direction. So, like, that makes me very excited. And we'll see. I think I'm not one to begrudge a work because of its source material. I think anything.
Finding Neverland. I'm just kidding. Nothing.
What?
Nothing.
Her? Never heard. I don't know her. I don't begrudge anything based off its source material. Anything could technically make a good musical from anything. You know, who would have thought that we'd have a rock musical based off of Jesus's Last Week? Not I. But
same.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's some. The proof is in the pudding. When you see it on stage, you gotta look at the pudding and you gotta say, is this pudding even decent? Is this store-bought pudding or is this homemade pudding? Not mean?
I do know what you mean. I honestly had no idea what you were talking about until you used a pudding metaphor and then I was right with you.
That's why I did it. I could feel you moving away and I was like, gotta bring him back. Bring in some stupid-ass food like pudding.
Pudding is not stupid. Yeah, well, I mean, we just had a ton of opinions about something we haven't even seen, and
I know
some of you might hate it, some of you might love it, some of you might be indifferent about it, but
yeah,
I can promise one thing: we'll all die in the end.
Yeah, listen, we all are gonna die.
And I've been thinking eventually to kind of like bookend this. I've been thinking about throwing myself my own funeral while I'm alive. I know that's like such a sitcom-y 80s thing to do. I'm pretty sure.
I mean, you stole that from Tom Sawyer.
Stole from Tom Sawyer and from a Golden Girls episode. But I've been thinking about it, and I really think next year on my birthday, instead of celebrating my birth, I might have an actual funeral. Because like, wouldn't it be?
Oh, like Katya did.
Yeah, wouldn't it just be really cool just to know what everyone would want to say about you once you're dead?
Oh my god, absolutely. I can't wait to give a eulogy.
Yeah, that's the thing. I want to hear people's eulogies. I'm so sad that one day I won't be able to hear people's eulogies. So maybe every decade I'll hold a funeral for myself, just in case.
Absolutely.
Just to be in the room where it happened, but didn't happen for me, because I'll be dead.
And see, I never got to have a sweet 16, so I would like to have my next birthday ride in on an elephant or a panther, and then have everyone just shower me with compliments. So we'll bookend it. I'll have the really like big party. You'll have the funeral. And then the following year, I'll have the funeral. You'll have the big elephant party.
Yeah. I've always said, anyways, that I probably want to be taxidermied when I'm dead. So it'll be mm-hmm. great because it'll already give everyone like a little bit of a preview, a little spoiler alert of what to expect my actual funeral, because I'll just be kind of like be mounted on the side of the stage. I imagine it'll happen on the stage somewhere that my funeral.
Yeah.
Probably at like Hardware Bar.
Oh my god.
That's
all you deserve.
It's all I deserve. And I'll just be frozen on the side as if I'm a bear. Yeah.
The only time in your life you'll ever be described as a bear.
Truly.
Well, oh my. Oh my, everybody.
Well, I feel like we've fixed everything today. Yeah, I socially, think theatrically. We discussed.
Yeah, exactly. We're
anally.
No, nothing will ever get fixed there. On that note, RIP my soul, along with a bunch of theater greats this week.
Yeah. Rip Neil Simon. Thanks for everything you did.
Yeah. Yeah. Barbara Harris, Craig Zaden.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There was someone else this week, I want to say. Didn't we? I feel like there was another person, and I'm going to feel really terrible if we forget.
I mean, if we forget, they'll still be dead in the next episode.
Oh, my God. Jesus.
Silver lining. Christ. You know?
Silver lining, everybody. Oh, RIP, this revival of Carousel. They will be closing.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it, and I know your opinions on it, and I know a lot of other people's opinions on it, and so I've been tempted to buy a ticket, but I still haven't made the leap. I don't know. Maybe I'll catch it. Maybe I will.
That is the danger of the internet, is that everyone listens to our episode where I discussed Carousel, and ticket sales just dropped immediately.
Truly. And you were single-handedly responsible for this revival closing.
Yep. And then our following episode where I discussed Sally Murphy, everyone was like, well, she's not going to be Julie Jordan. Why am I going to bother? I'm like, I know. That's all to say, I'm very much looking forward to all the projects that this cast is going to get up to next. It's such a talented cast. They're going to... Yeah. I'm not going to lose a wink of sleep.
Over Jesse Mueller, you know? Like,
yeah, or Joshua Henry, Lindsay Mendez, or anyone even in that ensemble. They're all so talented. They're going to get work immediately.
Yeah.
let's end this on a positive note. John, happy thought for the week for everybody out there, you know?
Coffee is wonderful and our vices are wonderful, but you yourself are just enough too, you know? Like, don't underestimate the power of not leaning on your crutches, because you don't really need your crutches all the time. That's what I've learned the last 4 weeks, and I really am standing by that, you know?
Good.
And I love that. So if that makes sense to any of you in any way possible, kudos. If not, go fuck yourself.
Go fuck yourself. My positive thought for the week is, yes, Pretty Woman and getting the band back together might be on Broadway right now, but Finding Neverland is not. So take comfort in that.
And take a shot.
And take a shot right now.
Take a shot of Bailey's or horchata, a nice milky liqueur. You have to take a shot of a milky liqueur every time you mention Finding Neverland. Milky.
That's milky liqueur. I feel like that should be a drag name.
Oh my gosh.
Hi everybody, I'm Milky Liqueur.
Milky Liqueur is my favorite character in Spring Awakening. On that note, thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. I'm done. We gotta end this shit. I think we should end this week's Diva with Barbara Harris.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's great.
I would do Neil Simon, but there's no audio of him singing, so we'll do Barbara Harris.
Brilliant. I support that.
Yes. Fantastic. All right. Have a good day, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
May the Lord open. Goodbye.
May the Lord open and keep you open.
Oh, honey.
Take us away, Barbara.
Bye.
Oh, honey. Bye.
Come on and see the hoot work.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit. that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.